You are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. It is 5 o'clock on Tuesday, so it is time for office hour. Before we begin, I just want to remind you that the views that are expressed on this show may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So welcome, 5 o'clock Tuesday, office hour. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And as always, we're going to go and knock on some door and find out some crazy and interesting and unusual and spectacular thing that someone on campus is investigating and thinking about. So you can hear me knocking. Now, it's kind of a special day for me today because every so often I take a break from talking to faculty. Not that I don't love talking to faculty, but I bring in some students because that's what we're all about. UC Davis is about student research. And I hope if there's any students out there, you realize that what's the point of being at a Research One institution is that every student should be involved in doing research. So in case there's any students or listeners out there who aren't doing research, I just wanted to give you my 30-second, okay, maybe more than 30-second introduction to doing research. You know, Michael Pollan, who did all that study of food, they asked him, they said, okay, Michael, just shrink it down and tell me what, you know, in one sentence, what do you think we should do when we approach our plate? Because we get so many different kinds of information. And he said, eat what grows from the ground and maybe eat less of it. So that's like the bumper sticker version of lots of it. So if we come to me and we'd say, people ask me, well, what does it mean to be an educated person? What does it mean to have gone to university? Or if not necessarily gone to university, but still, what does it mean to be an educated person? So my shrunken bumper sticker line is, what is an educated person? An educated person is someone who is engaged in research. Because every day you're probably, whether you know it or not, you're doing research or you're looking at other people's research. So I'm going to tell you one way to speed up your research life, which I hope everybody out there finds a research project in the next 24 hours. It's good for your health. You walk back and forth to the library, check out a lot of books. It's also good for the health of democracy. And I think that's really a serious point. So if you want to build a better democracy, then here's some suggestions. First of all, there's a wonderful book called The Craft of Research by Wayne Booth. In particular, just reading chapter 3, where he talks about from topics to questions, is a great way to get started. He tells you to find a problem and then find a question related to your problem, like why do cats rub their faces against us? That's a question. Now, where do you find a topic that you can then find a question from? Well, anybody who has a ucdavis.edu email address can get a free subscription to the New York Times. So I challenge you to look through an entire issue, a daily newspaper from the first page to the last page, and not find something in it that you find illuminating, upsetting, some topic you feel you want to argue about, you want to learn more about. And then you need to narrow down your topic and turn it into a good question. What makes a good research question? Well, let's look at some that are not good research questions. Do the Inuit use masks in their wedding ceremonies? Booth offers. Well, in that case, the answer is going to be yes or no, so it's not a great research question. You want something that's going to be more open-ended than that. Would church services be better attended if people wore masks to church services? Well, it may be hard to find data on that. Maybe you're going to go out and you aren't going to find a lot of people who do wear masks that you can study in order to find an answer to this question. So what you want to do is find a question that has that's open-ended, the answer is not yes or no, and that also is important to you. Why do you want to know the answer? What's the skin in the game? What's important to you about that question? And then you run to the library. I want to remind our listeners, every listener out there has access through the public terminals, which by state law we have in the UC Davis Library, to all of the wonderful material that's available, like the online material. So run to the library, get the librarian's help, learn how to use those terminals, and start doing your research. Now, if you aren't psyched up enough, I have two students today who are going to talk about their research and why it has been meaningful and important to them to do research. And then certainly by the end of hearing from them, you will be running to find your topics. So my first student I want to welcome to Office Hour is Francisco Quintana. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Right. And he's going to talk about his senior thesis, which he has just completed. Why does genocide denial continue? So we're going to be talking about that there is genocide denial and also that genocide denial continues. So what are the forces that operate in society so that people deny that genocides took place. And as always, before we start to talk about the particular research that you've done, we start with the question, why does a senior at Davis wake up one day and decide you want to study genocide? Okay, do you want to tell us a little bit about how you got interested in this topic, Francisco?
Well, yeah, so really it just lies in my passion for human rights and just for the desire to make, the desire and longing for the world to be a more egalitarian and fair place. And, naturally the thing that draws my interest, given that that is my ideal at heart, is what is probably the most unjust yet least, what persists that forms so much of our world, yet, we don't pay attention to it. And I think that genocide is really the thing that stands out to me because, so much of the demographic distribution of so many cultures and languages throughout the world, what we don't realize always is that, the reason that, we're here standing in California where we are is because there used to be people here that we displaced to build the society where we're living now. And I don't think that by and large, most people really realize how common that is. When we think of genocide, we tend to think of things like the Holocaust, which was, one of the most horrible and tragic episodes in human history. But we don't really think about the fact that things very similar to that have happened all over the world, including right here in Yolo and Solano counties.
Okay, so your question, your interest is in human rights.
Yeah.
And so we talk about within that, the topic that you want to focus on is genocide, because for you, that seems to be the heart of getting into human rights. It certainly seems that genocide does deny people their human rights. That seems like...
many, many ways, many dimensions of truth.
Exactly. But then what became of interest to you was exactly as we talk about here, finding a particular, more specific claim within the very large category of genocide, which is genocide denial. And why do you think that is particularly a place to start to study? Is it something that you found, you ran into and you found it was just particularly significant in the history of genocide?
I think it's primarily founded upon the principle that genocide denial is actually not a separate phenomenon from genocide itself. It's really just a continuation of a genocide, because when genocide happens, it's done with the goal to completely uproot a community and make it be as if it was never there to begin with. In order for that to work logically, you have to deny that that community was ever there, because a regime that proudly proclaims that it has exterminated any portion of its population is not going to be able to exercise its legitimacy internationally. It's not going to be able to exert the same amount of influence and power that it would have been able to had it not done these things. So when genocide is committed, it's always just by principle accompanied with a denial. You see this with, as I discuss in my paper, with Turkey and with Rwanda and so many cases of genocide where the perpetrators don't want to admit that this is what they were doing, that it was for the sake of their national security.
Okay. So what you're saying is that genocide denial is part of genocide itself.
Absolutely.
Because when people are eliminating some part of their population, they deny they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that strikes me as a somewhat modern view. It may be that there were times in history when you didn't have to be as much denial. It was just considered certain types of warfare.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying is that within the sort of the scope of political opinion and world opinion, now it's not a good thing to present yourself as decimating some subcategory or some people. So therefore, you're going to find a split between what people are doing and what people we're in the world of cover up now. We now live in the modern world of cover up.
Yeah. Definitely. So exactly. So my paper definitely mostly focuses on the 20th century, a century in which, there were massive networks of press and of, different systems and mechanisms of getting information out, to the rest of the world that didn't exist before. So it's not as easy, it hasn't been as easy in the last century to get away with a crime of this scale. In ancient history, what the Timurids or the Mongols did, those people killed like 12% of the population at the time of the entire world, not just of their country. But there was no way of getting that information to the rest of the world, and in a way in which everyone could be outraged about it. Also, just because daily life at the time, there weren't really any places where people were always completely safe from that. Whereas now, now that we have a higher standard of human rights, we have a stronger human rights regime where there is a conscience, an international one, that human life should not be subject to, you know, threats of life. You know, the four freedoms, you know, are something integral, not just to our values here in the United States, but, you know, all throughout the world, really. Mm-hmm.
So let's say you're a consultant. How do you help a regime deny genocide? I mean, what kinds of things do you have to do? It seems to me that in some ways you cannot necessarily deny what is happening. Mm-hmm. So what genocide denial might in part entail is reinterpretation of events.
Absolutely.
By trying to say that our frame of understanding what's happening is the way you need to think about what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's usually presented as a dilemma to the citizens of any particular regime. For instance, in the Ottoman annihilation of the Anatolian Armenians in 1915, the issue was presented as, if we don't remove these people from Eastern Anatolia, they're going to side with Russia and with allies, and they're going to take our land from us and kill us. Therefore, the only way the Turkish nation will survive is if we systematically exterminate these people and remove them from our land. But that was branded publicly as, we need to relocate the Armenians, relocate them to Deir ez-Zor, which is in Syria, one of the most inhospitable environments anywhere in the world. When you send people out knowing that they have no food or water, and you also empty prisons full of, you know, serial killers and criminals, promising them their land, the land of the Armenians that they're expelling if they go and kill them so that they can't come back and claim it after the war, which is exactly what they did. There was a desire by the Turkish nation to create an idea that made Anatolia as a landmass synonymous with the Turkish nation, which hasn't really ever been true until the last, you know, 90 years.
Because there were always different peoples living there.
Absolutely. The Greeks used to dominate the West Coast, the Armenians in the East, and, you know, there was never really a clear majority. What a lot of people don't realize is that prior to the Balkan revolutions throughout the 1800s, the majority of the Ottoman Empire was actually Christian, not Muslim, just because of all the minorities that they had. It was a pluralistic, multicultural, multi-ethnic, multinational state. And when you create a dilemma saying that we need to do this for our survival, the population and the government no longer sees it as, this is something we're doing to inflict victimhood upon these people. This is what we're doing to survive. We need to do this to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And be, yeah.
And so that's the main way that they sell the genocide is that they say that there's a lot of, we have to worry about these people doing bad things, you know, the sort of the themes that we're familiar with. Fear of these individuals, marginalization of them. But how do you get people to go along with that if you're trying to propagate genocide in the case of, because it seems like these are people who have been around for a long time. So again, if you're the consultant for the genocidal regime, how do you get this kind of cover up to be successful on such a large scale?
Well, I think it's primarily founded on the access to information that you give people. For instance, today it's built into Turkish jurisprudence that you can't insult the Turkish nation. Mm-hmm. It's illegal to do so. And by doing so, you kind of create a dilemma between the flag and the truth. You know, if you admit that these things happen, you were a traitor to our nation, and you are complicit with the people that are dedicated to the wholesale destruction of Turkey itself. And by doing that, not only do you, you know, forcibly restrict information by law, people aren't allowed to tap into those archives, and the archives that did exist were destroyed. The only evidence we have of the Armenian genocide comes from archaeological, you know, endeavors that people have gone to Turkey, and it survives also in the documentation of many foreign diplomats and missionaries that were present in the Ottoman Empire at the time. But basically, what you do is you create a situation in which admitting to something, or where entertaining even the idea that Turkey was guilty for what it did, you give people the sense that they're betraying their own country. And by that, you are really just, because really what matters is that the Turkish people go with the Turkish version of history. They don't care about what the rest of the world does.
Mm-hmm. But they do it for a reason, you're saying. You're arguing that, you know, you actually make a kind of a strategic kind of argument in which you have them appeal to some other set of principles, which seems to outweigh the value of the people you're trying to get rid of. And this is the ideal of the nation, certainly something we're familiar with, the ideal of the Turkish people, the idea of protecting the nation and caring for the nation. These are all values that are recognizable to us.
Yes, exactly. And exactly what you just said, it's precisely that. Given that you have an idea of national pride and national conscience that the Turkish people need to protect at all costs, it becomes a rational course of action to mm-hmm. deny the genocide. Because if you admit that genocide happened, well, then you kind of admit that the entire society that you're standing on, everything you benefit from, is founded on the bloodshed of other people.
Which is distressing. Mm-hmm. So now you contrast that in here with the case of Germany. And your argument basically is that the Germans had to admit what they did basically because they lost the war. Mm-hmm. So the best, what happens is genocide denial doesn't happen if they lose the war. Mm-hmm. Because once they've lost the war, then they can't perpetrate the kinds of ideas they had before. They have to face up to it. And that Germany is an example of a country that has really faced up to it and does not engage in Holocaust and denial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Germany is an excellent example of that, because you had after World War II, you had the Nuremberg trials, where mm-hmm. the people who, you know, orchestrated the Holocaust were brought to court and mm-hmm. were prosecuted for their crimes. You also had, you know, immediately after, the Jewish people were compensated in many ways, including one of which gave them national self-determination in the form of the State of Israel, which to this day, the Mossad hunts down people that participated in the Holocaust. So
right to this day.
So people that go out and say, yeah, we're proud of this. We committed the Holocaust. You know, that you're putting a target on your back in many, many different ways. Number one, you could have been taken to jail via Nuremberg, or the Mossad would hunt you down, you know, mm-hmm. just like they did Eichmann. The famous Eichmann trial, where, you know, the perpetrators mm-hmm. of the Holocaust were, you know, under the fist of jurisprudence, were made to admit what they did, because there was no space mm-hmm. for them to say that.
But, you know, in some ways, it's a rather sobering and somewhat sad conclusion that you come to there, because mm-hmm. in that contrast, I guess the presumption is that, you know, unless the Turks are militarily defeated, which seems unlikely they'd be militarily defeated, mm-hmm. There's no reason for a regime to admit that they engaged in slaughter of people, mm-hmm. and that Germany, it was only admitted because Germany, lost the war. So that it really Holocaust or any kind of genocide denial is really dependent simply on who is the most powerful player around at any moment. Don't you find that a little bit depressing? Isn't there any other impetuses towards fighting the question of genocide denial? What do you think?
I think states are ultimately rational actors, and I don't think that human rights is their first, second, or third priority. It is a really sad conclusion, but that's essentially my whole point. My central thesis is that states will only own up to what they did if they are held accountable for it. And in order for them to be held accountable, they have to be completely defeated militarily. That's why Rwanda is another good example, alongside Germany, of a country that has really stepped up, because Paul Kagame, they went in and brought down the Hutu nationalist government, and all those people were taken to jail, and they don't have the power, the institutional tools that allow them to deny genocide and to control the national conscience of the nation no longer exists. So they are in a way forced to own up to it, and it's sad, but unfortunately there's nothing pointing to the opposite. People won't just say, oh, I did this, because they only stand to lose. If you mm-hmm. if you admit that you commit genocide, there's no way that could benefit you.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's try to imagine just for a moment, because that's what we do when we think about these. We just imagine under what scenario might that change? Mm-hmm. Can you ever imagine? I mean, your argument from political science point of view is very much that states, you know, have no thing. Their states are not going to do things that do not benefit them. Mm-hmm. But can you imagine a world in which people become interested in genocidal history and decide that they even maybe not without the government? I mean, I must imagine, as someone who's focusing on human rights and someone who wants to see this as a tool to change the future, mm-hmm. can you imagine that in fact happening in the future, where people, even if it wasn't at the state's interest, people might be willing to rise up and do something that's not based on the interest of the state?
To be totally honest with you, no.
That's really
sad, but I don't think so, because, you know, what usually comes with admitting genocide, you know, you have reparations, you have compensation, you have, repatriation oftentimes. And, you know, if all of a sudden all the descendants of Anatolian Armenians, they want to go back home, well, then you have another dilemma of displacement. You know, it's really, really hard to make up for something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the best way to imagine that is, you know, here in the United States, you know, many of us in academia are very, very conscious of what happened to the Native Americans and the wholesale mm-hmm. destruction of that civilization. But then again, you ask yourself, you know, is there really ever a way that we could give them their land back? And the answer is it would be very difficult. And really, it's just no one has really ever figured that out, because obviously the reservations have been a failure. They've just mm-hmm. kind of kept them in, you know, economic turmoil for the last.
Well, they often weren't their land.
Yeah.
They often were some other land that the government picked to put people on there.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, if you let's put the, your, you know, put your thinking cap on the other, you're hired by a different kind of regime,
mm-hmm.
By people in California or Americans who do want to do something about. Mm-hmm. One of the points you're making is that by not admitting to genocidal acts in history, mm-hmm. that's very bad for the state. It becomes embalmed in the state, and it means that you have to continually cover up. So let's say we did decide we wanted to do something different. What would be a meaningful way to try to deal with it beyond the German way of having militarily being defeated? Well, what would you suggest? I mean, if you were in charge of the United States in their relations with the Native Americans, or maybe you're in charge of the school systems or any mechanism that you think would be helpful for us to try to think through how that fits into our history, what would you recommend?
I would go off of the model that Germany went off of with the Holocaust, and the answer is education. Education is the most important tool towards getting a population on board with coming to terms with its past and ensuring that it is able to, you know, the population at large is aware of what happened and they pay their respects properly and they acknowledge that everything that they're standing on was built on blood. And I think that once we become, once we kind of go start, and it's starting to happen, thankfully, but once we start to go away from the, you know, idea that, you know, there were explorers that discovered America and,
right.
and built the country, maybe we might realize that, you know, our history isn't very pretty, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what happened here was horrible.
I'm curious, are you in favor of reparations for slavery as well?
I honestly, it is definitely, it's not something I know much about,
mm-hmm.
But I think that I am, ideally, yes, I do. I think that there should be reparations for people, victims of injustice, period. And slavery is one such example of that.
Yes, and certainly on a large scale mm-hmm. with a whole large group of people. So it's not just an individual problem. It was really, like genocide, it has to do with a population.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. I think that reparations would be very, very good. I think that'd be a good first step for the African-American community. Unfortunately, I don't know in what way those reparations would come. I don't know much about that topic. But I think that the most important thing is education, because people have to be aware as to why they need to give back. People need to be aware of what happened. Like, why do we need to, you know, recognize what happened to the Native Americans? Why is it important?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer is we destroyed their livelihood. And the reason that we are what we are now is largely because of blood. And that's really just a very common theme in, like, throughout all the world. You know, there are very few nations in the world that have never had genocide happen on their land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think, I'm trying to find out if there's anything optimistic we can also find at the end of this. Do you think that, I mean, in just the last few minutes we're talking about here, do you think genocide is becoming, when I say less popular? I mean, it seems like an odd way to think about it. Mm-hmm. But do you think the kind of social mechanisms we have to try to prevent this are going to be your generation? You're studying, you're thinking about human rights. Maybe your generation will do a better job
mm-hmm.
than my generation did on a cosmic scale. I mean, there's a lot of global identification in your generation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see optimism in that way, that it will not be as important a political tool in the future?
I think something that is something positive about this is the fact that the world is becoming a lot more interconnected. So it's becoming a lot harder to hide these things, and it's becoming a lot harder to deny them. But even then, I think that it's not always a guarantee, because, you know, today in Myanmar, what's happened to the Rohingya people,
mm-hmm.
That has been classified by many human rights activists, including myself. I wouldn't call myself a human rights activist yet. Hopefully one day.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what's happening there is genocide. Absolutely. They're attempting to exterminate a population. But, you know, it's being met with more outrage and more pressure from the international community than the Holocaust was. So mm-hmm. hopefully that will get the Myanmarese government to think twice before following down that path. I think something else to take into account is the fact that when genocide is committed, people aren't going to be able to stay quiet. The state is not going to be able to keep things on a cap because we have social media now and mm-hmm. we have the news and things like that are going to make people more aware of what's happening. But I would still not take that for granted as something to guarantee that it's never going to happen again. And what I always tell people when they ask me this question is that Germany was a much better place for Jews before the Holocaust than France or Britain or America was. Germany was one of the best places for Jews, actually. And look what happened there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's why we can't really take, you know, just the principles of freedom and democracy as a given. I think that the best guarantee is that every person in the world has a state that will accept them and advocate for them and never discriminate or hurt them just based on their national, ethnic, religious, or social origin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Francisco, what's next for you? You're a senior, right? So
yeah.
You're getting ready to get out of here. So where are you going to go? What's the next chapter in your life?
So I'm currently studying for the LSAT. It has completely taken over my life. It's really all I ever do. Everything that I think about and everything that I see, I think in terms of logic games and logical reasoning with the LSAT. It's just, it's all I think about nowadays.
Okay, so, well, I'm glad you took a little time out of that to talk about genocide.
Yeah.
And do you want to leave us with, do you have a thought question for the listeners just to think about where you sort of see your research going and something they might be thinking about? Maybe they'll take a research topic out of this and go to the library themselves to follow up on genocide.
Well, what I would say is, think about where you're standing right now or think about where you're from and, you know, scratch the dirt a little bit and see if genocide has ever been a part of the land you come from. And you'd probably be surprised because the answer is probably going to be yes at some point. And think about how you pay respects and how you acknowledge the fact that the society that we're benefiting from is largely built on blood and mm-hmm. the importance of just realizing what that is. So
okay.
Scratch the dirt a little bit.
Well, scratch the dirt. That's certainly a sobering question, sobering thought for the end. We've come to the end of the first half of Office Hour. We're going to be back and talking with another student on a completely different topic. So stay with us, and we will be back after a short break. So welcome back. This is the second half of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and we are making a special knocking on doors today to find out what students are doing. They're seniors, they're getting ready to graduate, so we want to find out what's on their mind, what they've been learning this year before they head out into the world. And we are really changing gears here. We were talking about genocide, and we're going to shift and talk now about obscure religions. So I want to welcome Tara Charvini to the show. So welcome, Tara.
Thank you for having me.
Right. And you are a major in NPB, right?
Yes. So,
which is
neurobiology, physiology, and behavior.
Okay, so that mouthful there. But despite being a science major, Tara has been working and studying religion, as actually a large number of students do. And she's in particular been studying Zoroastrianism. And my guess is that a lot of the listening audience doesn't know much about Zoroastrianism. So buckle your seatbelt because you're going to get an initiation into one of the more obscure but quite fascinating religions of the world. So as always, we start off with the question of how does someone in NPB start to do research in Zoroastrianism? I doubt you ran into it in any of your science classes.
No, yes, did not run into it there. So my family is actually Zoroastrian. My parents were born in Iran and moved to America when they were very young. And I've grown up in a Zoroastrian household, but it's Zoroastrianism is different from a lot of the other religions that are popular today. It's not not so much, definitely not popular, not very well known. And in terms of religious practices, we do quite a few things different.
Right. So now growing up Zoroastrian, I'm just curious, did you ever run into Zoroastrianism in school? For example, in sixth grade when they do, I know many of the California schools teach an introduction to religion, and they probably talked a little bit about Judaism, a little bit about Christianity, maybe a little bit about Hinduism. Did they ever, when you were growing up, did you ever hear anybody talking about Zoroastrian religion in any of your school systems?
No, never. And even when I bring it up today to my friends, most of them are like, oh, Zoroastrianism, you know, what's that?
Uh-huh. So it didn't happen. So you decided that you single-handedly are going to change that by going out and studying it.
Yes.
Okay. So we've got a lot of different aspects to talk about, because when you start to study Zoroastrianism, which you came and you told me you wanted to study, I warned you that there were going to be problems studying Zoroastrian religion. And this is true of a lot of the religions. We have many students at Davis. We have many people in the community who belong to what we call minority religions. And it's not always easy to study a minority religion. So when you tell us a little bit about the struggles you had just studying Zoroastrianism.
Sure. So there were definitely quite a few problems that I encountered along my journey of research. First and foremost, a lot of the texts of Zoroastrianism have been destroyed. The history of Zoroastrianism is a history of destruction, particularly during the spread of Muslim throughout the Middle East, the spread of Islam. But also before that, there's been a history of destruction of the texts, during the so Zoroastrianism is one of the oldest religions. The date of origin is put around maybe 5000 BCE, but that date still varies a lot. So even before the spread of Islam, there are multiple millenniums in which, texts were destroyed, a period of changing empires, wars. So that was a source of difficulties.
Okay, so
finding texts.
So when you say texts were destroyed, they were destroyed as part, how does it happen that religious texts are destroyed? We don't think of that as being like a general activity, going out and destroying religious texts. We think of them as being somewhat protected. But I guess what we would be talking about there is change of empires, that when there was political change, cities would be destroyed, texts would be destroyed.
Yes.
And I think in the case of the Zoroastrian texts, and this is important for any of you out there thinking of starting your own religion, there weren't always large numbers of the texts. So if you had a city that would be burned, it would be a tremendous loss because you might lose the only copy of a particular religious text.
Right.
And the long, complicated history of the area in Iran and changing times. And then, as you said, the next big challenge was the rise of Islam.
Yes. So the rise of Islam came with a whole other level of difficulties for Zoroastrians, not just in terms of the destruction of the texts, but more culturally so, and that Zoroastrians faced a lot of discrimination and harassment in the Middle East, and that has led to the dispersal of most Zoroastrians, so that today the large populations of Zoroastrians are in primarily in America, in India, and in Iran.
So that's the many, many Zoroastrians who did want to be Zoroastrians fled. Though I imagine you're talking about hundreds of years.
Yes.
So they've been fleeing for hundreds of years, right? So what is it about the Islamic attitude towards Zoroastrianism what was the problem with Zoroastrianism from the viewpoint of Islam?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure mm-hmm. that I necessarily have an answer to that, but I can tell you that on a widespread basis, there was the issue. Zoroastrianism as a whole is a very ethical religion, in that the main forms of practice are in practicing good thoughts, good deeds, and good words, which is our principal tenet. And in that way, Zoroastrianism is pretty unique to these to the other big religions of the world, where people might go to church every day or pray multiple times a day. And Zoroastrianism differs in that the mode of practice and the mode of worship is up to the practicer and believer themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and I think generally Zoroastrianism, it was not recognizable to many people, as it is also not recognizable today, because it isn't a recognized religion of the book, like Christianity and like Judaism as well. So it wasn't recognizable, which is an odd thought, but that continues today, that that there's some religions which we have categories for, and Zoroastrianism doesn't fit into. We can even consider whether there is such a simple thing as Zoroastrianism, because it's been through so many changes over time. So so Islam also did not foster these texts and these traditions and these ideas, but yet they were passed on.
Right.
And that's really quite a striking lesson for us about how religion works. So how is it that you were able to study anything about Zoroastrian given this complicated history?
So there are a number of texts. So the primary text of Zoroastrianism is what we call the Avesta. It's the equivalent of a Bible for Zoroastrians. And within the category of the Avesta, there are different, maybe like sub-books. And many of the prayers that are in these holy texts are designed to be, you know, spoken aloud, and they're designed to be passed on orally. So when the text itself is destroyed, many of the prayers and the worship practices mm-hmm. can be passed on orally. And in that sense, that's been what's predominated.
Mm-hmm. And that's certainly your experience. So now we get to your experience of Zoroastrianism, which is very much what was passed on in your particular family. In other words, the main way in which you were exposed to these religious traditions was primarily through your family unit and not through other modes of other religious institutions, which might differ from, you know, other people, for example, Christians who had churches and Catholics have popes. And you know, Zoroastrianism doesn't have those institutional bases in your life very much.
Yeah,
is that true?
That's true. You could think of it that way. We do have priests. Actually, my grandfather was a Zoroastrian priest before he passed away. And you could think about, in terms of texts, you know, there was 16 different volumes of the text. And today, only one of them is in circulation and is very popular. The other 15 have had bits and pieces passed down orally.
Mm-hmm. So there's little bits of literature, a lot of family traditions. Your grandfather was a Zoroastrian priest. So now everybody's wondering, well, yeah, but what is Zoroastrianism? You know, did they want to know, do you have to add new holidays to the calendar? You know, what kinds of things do you believe? So we're, again, on a fairly, going to have to summarize it because we don't have forever. But, you know, what do you, if you wanted to give someone the greatest hits of Zoroastrian religion, so they could now no longer be that person who never heard of it. Okay, every listener out there will now know there is something called Zoroastrianism. It's an ancient religion that came from Iran and now it's passed on. So, you know, what are the great hits that you found in your research?
So Zoroastrianism is what many scholars believe to be the first prophetic religion. And our god is called Ahura Mazda. So we're monotheistic. And the central tenet of practice is good thoughts, good deeds, and good words. So if a person is considered a follower of God, you practice good thoughts, good deeds, and good words. And on the other hand, you know, we have the equivalent of the devil, and a person who's possessed by the devil or who's demonic doesn't practice good thoughts, good deeds, and good words. So that's kind of the dualism between good and bad in the religion.
Right. And Zoroastrianism is often associated with a very strong dualism, a strong good and a strong bad. But how do you know? How do you know what's good thoughts? How do you know which thoughts are good? How do you know what is good?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think that comes down to the believer and the practicer in themselves, what they consider good versus bad.
Mm-hmm. But I can't imagine you just make it up on your own. There must be some mechanism by which the idea of good is regulated and inculcated. From you, I guess, came from your grandfather, that he had a strong feeling of what was good and passed it on, I presume, as a Zoroastrian priest. So what might he tell you was good?
Of course. So in Zoroastrianism, typically what's considered good is honesty is very important. The idea of truth is also very central. And as a Zoroastrian, the first couple prayers that you learn emphasize truth and going out and seeking your own knowledge and educating yourself so that you can find your own truth.
Mm-hmm. So this is part of the prayer. So you grew up saying the prayers about honesty and truth.
Yes.
You did. So, and just how do you pray then if you don't necessarily have a strong institute? You said there are Zoroastrian temples in San Jose, but just did you just pray on your individual own with your family and at the
table?
Yeah,
so the manner of worship is very personal to the practicer. At least for myself, you know, just saying a prayer before I go to bed every night, to me, that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grew up in the Bay Area, and our nearest temple is, as you said, in San Jose, but that's still quite a distance. You know, it's not like Christianity where you can just, go down your street or whatnot, and there'll be a church right there. You know, there is quite a distance you have to travel to get to a temple.
Mm-hmm.
So practicing from where you are located, a lot of times, is what suffices.
Mm-hmm. So what other kinds of Zoroastrian things did you do growing up besides reciting prayers?
So you mentioned holidays earlier. One of the big holidays isn't necessarily specific to Zoroastrians, but it is Persian New Year, and it falls on the first day of spring. And so all Persians, what we do is, it's almost the equivalent of Christmas. So instead of a Christmas tree, we have a table, and instead of ornaments, we put different items on the table, and each item represents something different.
Mm-hmm.
And so Zoroastrians, so all Persians put seven different items that each start with the letter S. And Zoroastrians, in addition to those seven, we also put seven different items that start with the SH sound. So that's kind of a cultural holiday, you could say, that's of significance.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of your, so you have a liturgical calendar and you have the new year. Now, Zoroastrianism is often associated with, in addition to dualism, that's one of the big things. And you mentioned that, the idea of a strong devil-like figure who's fighting good-like figures. And often that's talked about in the history of Judaism and Christianity. People talk about whether there was influence of this Zoroastrian traditions came into Judaism and Christianity, which also have a strong notions of dualism, a fight of between good and evil. But another thing that's associated with Zoroastrianism is the idea of purity and purification through fire. And I think that's kind of an interesting point. It's also maybe, for some of our listeners, the only thing they've ever heard about Zoroastrian religion is that it's associated with fire. So maybe you want to tell us a little bit about that.
So there exists quite a large misconception, actually, that Zoroastrians are fire worshippers, which is not true. We do consider fire to be a symbol of purity and a symbol of wisdom. You know, it's associated with our God, and it's considered that fire is almost the mechanism with which God shares his purity and his wisdom through man with mankind. And so in many, in almost all of the ceremonies and rituals, there is fire involved, you know, whether it's just maybe a candle being lit or whatnot. But that's not to say that we worship fire itself. And actually, a lot of times saying that Zoroastrians are fire worshipers has been used as almost a derogatory description, you could say, of Zoroastrians in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't surprise me. I when we were talking before, we were talking about how people say Buddhists worship rocks because they have stones. In other words, it's often hard for people on the outside. And one of the things that you, when you were studying Zoroastrianism, and I noticed this in the work, is that there isn't a lot of material that's written on the religion.
There's not.
So here you were. You were sent off trying to do research, and this may be a warning for people out there. If you pick a topic that's something that's not a great deal that's written on, but that also seems to be something that's in changing right now.
Yeah. So there are definitely only a few academic texts related to Zoroastrianism. Part of the issue is the mere quantity, and the other problem that I've noticed is that the number of scholars, you know. One of the most popular scholars on Zoroastrianism is Mary Boyce, who's now passed away, and most of her publications were put out in the 60s. So that's obviously quite an amount of time has passed since then. And the new generation of scholars that are studying Zoroastrian aren't actually Zoroastrian themselves, which may be interesting to see how the shift in academia arises because of that.
Mm-hmm. So why are they studying Zoroastrianism? Just because it's such a fascinating...
It is. It's very interesting. At least personally, I think it's very interesting to see how the popular religions today, the big three, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, it's interesting to see what bits and pieces those three have borrowed from Zoroastrianism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us anything about, if we go back and we look at the scope of Zoroastrianism, how it arose? And I presume that we know almost nothing about that since we know so little about the religion in the first place. But I know one of the things that you tried to look at, it was what was the religion before Zoroastrianism in Iran, and what did you find?
Right. So like you said, there's such little information about Zoroastrianism that studying the religion that came before that, you know, you can almost imagine how little I found in books and online. But what I did find is there seems to be a common trend of a shift from multi-deity religions and polytheism towards Zoroastrianism, which is very monotheistic. And many of the sources that I was reading emphasized that Zoroastrianism shifted away from the superstition and the pagan practices of the previous religions to emphasize more ethical practices, more self-reflection, more honesty, more truth, more personal integrity.
Well, we realize that that is not their view, right? That's
right.
Not the religions that were then, the religious ideas. They did not see themselves that way in relationship to Zoroastrianism.
Of course.
So it's very important that we don't quite know what that, but I think that's a very important point because I think the Tara has pointed out something that often happens with my students when we talk about just the breadth of people who come to Davis and study, that they may come from traditions where new traditions came in and replaced old traditions, and it's very hard to find out what had happened. We're recently talking about what was Tibetan religion before Buddhism came in, for example. And it's hard for us to go back and find sources, particularly in places where we don't have much oral traditions. And we try to imagine what the shift was. So what did it mean to Zoroastrianism? And your argument is that while it does seem to be a monotheizing tradition, a tradition in which you have more emphasis on a single god, in that case, it sounds very familiar to the stories we've seen from other religions where move from a multiplicity of gods to an individual type god. And then the way in which these traditions frozen from this time then get carried on in the written text and a little bit that's passed on today, all the way down to you, which is quite amazing. So what is the state of Zoroastrianism today then?
So today, as I said, most of the practitioners of the religion are in the U.S., Iran, and India. And I would say, I looked this up actually, the number of Zoroastrians in practice today is actually around 250,000.
A quarter of a million. But I mean, for example, like your grandfather, how did he become a priest? Is there some kind of centralized authority today that designates who's going to be a Zoroastrian priest? Or given as a minority religion and one that has to flee, I imagine it's quite difficult to keep any. So how did your grandfather become a priest? Do you know?
I actually don't know. That's not something I ever had the chance to ask him. I imagine, though, that it's something that's passed on generation from generation. Where that started, I'm not sure of.
Mm-hmm.
But if I wanted to go out and become a Zoroastrian priest, you know, there are a few figures that I know that I'd go to, and I'm sure I'd have to go through a number of ceremonies and rituals.
So do you think you could become a Zoroastrian priest? That would be pretty interesting. Are women becoming Zoroastrian priests today?
Oh, of course, yeah. Women can definitely become Zoroastrian priests.
Okay. So, and in terms of what do you see as the future of Zoroastrianism being, I think it's a very interesting question. In a way, Zoroastrianism now has a place in American society that is not a persecuted minority. It's just a misunderstood minority. And maybe this will be a new kind of Zoroastrianism will start to flourish in America today.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to imagine that Zoroastrianism would ever expand to the widespread nature that it once did. But I do see what you're saying. It's not that hard to imagine a world in which, you know, a new generation, my generation of Zoroastrians can prosper in America.
Well, why do you say, I'm just curious, why do you say you can't see it expanding in that way? Do you think that there's some way in which Zoroastrianism doesn't mesh well with modern culture?
No, not at all. I meant that more in terms of the breadth of the religion. So back when it was popular, you know, in the early, you know, like 1000 BC to 1000 AD, Zoroastrianism spread from the edge of Greece all the way up to the southern border of Russia through part of India. So, you know, that's such a large population that it's difficult to imagine that many people today converting to Zoroastrianism when there's only 250,000 of us out there.
Right. Have to do a lot of proselytizing. So if you could learn stuff more about Zoroastrianism in the future, what are the questions you would like to pursue? You haven't written and published this yet, but there's a lot that isn't known and would be great material that people could use to teach. What do you think is the next frontier of Zoroastrian studies?
I think something that we discovered has been very underexplored is the idea of what existed before it. You know, how did Zoroastrian spread and extend to such a wide area like I just described? You know, how did it spread through half of Europe and almost all of Asia? I think that's an interesting avenue to turn down.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the other thing you would have to be doing at some point is you would have to start to learn languages.
Yes, yeah.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I do speak Farsi. My writing and reading, that's a whole nother issue. But verbally, I'm very fluent. And the language of the ancient texts, that's medieval Farsi. So that's something that I'm sure in America, very few people, I imagine, can read medieval Farsi.
So how hard would that be for you coming from modern Farsi to medieval? Would it be like us reading Chaucer, for example? It would look like English, but we would find some of the words confusing?
I think that's part of it. The other part of it is the actual written alphabet is a little bit different from my understanding. You know, the way the words are written, it's different.
Mm-hmm. So, but that's what most of the Zoroastrian texts are written in?
The original ones, yes. Today they've been converted to modern Farsi, and there's also copies in English too, for those of us who can't read and can't read fluently in Farsi.
Have all, when you were doing your research, did you find that most of the Zoroastrian sources are available in English if somebody wanted to go out and just like they wanted to learn about it?
No, there's actually very few, but the popular, the main Avesta text, so, you know, if I wanted to go out and find the Zoroastrian equivalent of the Bible, I could find it in English, I could find it in Farsi, and I'm sure I could find it in a couple of Indian languages as well.
Mm-hmm. So this would be the path to study would be then you'd have to learn the languages because there's so many texts, as you say, that have not been translated. So this is a topic in which lots to do and very little has been done. That
yes.
seems to see on everything we get on everything you kept coming up with that point there. So is there anything else about sort of if people wanted to sort of understand it's always a very dangerous question to compare religions, particularly when religions you don't know very much about. And you have talked about the emphasis on right thought. But it seems in many ways that Zoroastrianism is actually fairly familiar. And that's one of the things that I was struck when you were doing your research and coming and talking with me about what you were finding, that there's some ways in which it's quite familiar to us. Not well known, but it's a familiar set of ideas that for one reason or another, I don't think it's that different theologically from things you might be more familiar with in Judaism and Christianity.
Yeah, you know, the idea of good versus evil, you know, God versus devil, those are definitely commonalities between most of the major religions today and Zoroastrianism.
Yeah, so it wouldn't be like studying something that was maybe not as big a leap even as going to Hinduism and Buddhism.
No, not a big leap at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, they also have a sense of purity, which was also familiar from Judaism. And then they also had rituals around death.
Yes. So a lot of the commonalities between Judaism and Zoroastrianism have to do with the population of Jews that lived under Persian rule during the time of the Persian Empire. And there are those similarities, as you said, between the practices around death of Zoroastrianism and Christianity. And one of the most interesting things that I read is that Zoroastrians actually, way back when, they actually condemned cremation. It was considered to be almost impure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And why is that so interesting? Because you think that that's a parallel or?
Well, it just struck me as interesting that, you know, that would be something specifically that was condemned where otherwise you consider fire to be a symbol of purity. You might think that when a person passes, you know, cremation might be almost like embodying them in the purity of God. So I thought it was interesting that it's actually looked down upon.
Mm-hmm. So whatever the purification theory that you have of fire going on there is complicated.
Yes.
In the Zoroastrian system.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's complicated on that. So, okay, so do you have a thought question that you want to leave? We're almost at the end of the show, that you would like to leave our listeners with to think about Zoroastrianism?
I think the main takeaway is to really ask yourself what value there is and what you can take away from studying not just Zoroastrianism, but other minority religions. Because, at least for Zoroastrianism, it's very easy to overlook the commonalities and the trends and the different ideas that Zoroastrianism has contributed to our everyday lives if you don't know much about it.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that you grew up, you almost felt invisible with your religion, and now you know more about it, and you think people should look at other minority religions as well.
Yes,
and
of course.
And that even though it's a small, it may not be a very common religion, it doesn't mean it isn't important. In the case of Zoroastrianism, we've seen a lot of potential influences from Zoroastrian traditions in other to other religious traditions, and it's alive.
Yeah.
Here it is,
very
living
much
here,
alive.
Very much alive right here in you in 2019. So I want to thank Tara, and I also want to thank Francisco very much for both coming in today and talking about their research. And you can always listen to this show over again or any of our archives. They're available on officehourucdpodcast.com. And we're going to go back to faculty researches, but once a year I like to just remind everybody out there that every student, if you know a student or you are a student at UC Davis, that it's the great advantage of being in an R1 university is that you're able to do your own research. And I hope that everybody does research, whether you're a student or not. We have the given the outlines of how to go out and find a topic, ask a question, and you have one of a world-class library here to help you start to investigate that. So the moral of this is think about genocide, think about Zoroastrianism, but most of all, think about something that you want to know something about, because you'll be increasing the frontiers of knowledge for your entire society. So with that thought, thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with another interview.